I have this really interesting view on life. I honestly don't feel that someone has to lose in order for someone to win. I feel like everyone can win and you can have it all.
Hey, it's Nate DeSaro, and welcome to Titans of Industry, the podcast where I talk to industry leaders and innovators who are at the top of their game and leading the pack in their fields, uncovering some of the best stories in today's business landscape. In today's episode, I sit down with Dan Wise, an artist manager in the Nashville music industry. Dan talks about how fake it till you make it actually works, how he opted for practical experience over an academic path, and how hustling helped him end up on a management team that is home to artists like Kelly Clarkson and Blake Shelton. And now let's get to the episode. But before we do, it's important to know that whether you're a small business owner or the face of a multi-billion dollar industry, your organization has a great story to tell, and Content Titan wants to help you tell it. We are a digital content creation powerhouse built for the 21st century, providing all-in creative, strategic, production, post-production, and distribution services for a 360-degree, 24/7 world. In our world, Titans are passionate, creative doers. They have the experience to take your project from start to finish, minimizing your involvement so you can focus on what matters most, running your business. So if you're ready to take your content strategy and production to the next level, our Titans are ready to help. Now, here's my conversation with Dan Wise. All right, so we're here at Starstruck Entertainment in the green room. I don't know how many people have come in and enjoyed this facility, but here with Dan Wise. Dan, it's great to be with you today. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So just wanted to jump right in and get your background. Where are you from? How did you get into the music business?
Originally from Las Vegas, or a little suburb called Henderson, Nevada. In high school, moved to San Diego. So I spent a lot of time there. But music business, I started in high school. I was really excited. So, playing in band in junior high. And I've always wanted to be the leader. So in junior high, playing band, I would go to the teacher and I would say, I want to conduct. And she did. She bought me a baton and a case, and I got to conduct the whole band, right? And so it was always kind of like taking that role of more of a leadership role in music. So when I started playing bass, I realized the creative bass playing wasn't for me, but I wanted to produce. I wanted to be in the studio. So in high school, interned at studios around Vegas. One of them was Digital Insight, was what it was called. And I can't remember the name of the owner, but, I was probably 15 years old, have no idea what I'm doing in life. And the owner of the studio is probably 28 years old, driving a Ferrari, and I was just like, thought that it was the coolest thing in life, and watching all these local bands come up in this really awesome studio in Vegas. But I remember my mom driving me an hour every single day after school to go intern at the studio for me to go in and like wash this guy's car and clean the bathrooms and, do all that, just in hopes that I can sit in one session, And so, I was really interested in kind of that, like taking a step back and in overseeing, I guess, the process of music. So from there, I kind of really got interested in sound, right? So audio engineering. So I started mixing live sound and doing some like technical theater stuff in high school and just kind of, recording buddies' bands and stuff like that in the house, and got really interested in that process. So when I moved to San Diego, I was just looking for any sort of random job, anything that I could find. And there was an audio company hiring to build speakers or something. And I just needed a summer job before the plan was to go to college in San Diego. And this audio company turns out to be one of the largest audio companies in the world as far as live touring production. So at 18, I got this job at this company called Sound Image at Escondido, California. And building speakers, which was horrible. It was the worst because they weren't like wooden speakers. They were like carbon fiber composite, like chemicals. And it was horrible. It was horrible. I mean, it's a really cool company. People were great, but it was horrible. So 3 months in, I just went to the boss and I just said that this isn't what I'm made to do. So if you have another role for me, I'll take it. Otherwise, unfortunately, I'm going to have to walk away. And our first person, in the music industry really that kind of gave me a shot was him, and his name's Rick Stanley out of San Diego, and he really kind of was just like, okay, well, let's dive in, and kind of threw me into the fire. And within less than a year of being with that company, they put me on the road, and they sent me on tour with my very first professional tour was a country artist named Mary Chapin Carpenter. She's still around touring. She's awesome. And I remember that being my first tour, and I'm 18 years old on a tour bus, like, whoa, this is great, you know, making more money than anybody my age, and just really excited. And that just kind of led to more tours and more tours and more tours. And college ended up being a distant memory or a distant thought.
So I'm curious what you did on those tours. Were you audio engineer?
I was kind of a tech as I learned. And then, you know, when bands would have a support act, I would go mix the support act or whatever. And just kind of, that was kind of definitely a learning process when you're 18, sure, sure. You know. But anyone from, you know, I was a tech for a long time, but anyone from Mary Chapin Carpenter to like Jimmy Buffett and, you know, and yeah, some people like that. So that's awesome. It was great.
So started kind of from a tech side, you were intrigued with audio and all the technical stuff, but then eventually I guess it moved into more of a management role.
Yeah. I think I was still only maybe 19 or 20. And I remember the guy I mentioned a little bit ago, Rick Stanley, but still a dear friend of mine and somebody that I respect more than anything, that probably taught me the most about just being a good human being. His name's John Shimke, and he's a good friend, a business partner. He's just a great guy. But he gave me my first real opportunity to production manage and to mix sound for Jason Mraz when he was first coming up, when his very first single broke and he was starting to tour a lot. And I ended up working for Jason for a long time. But that experience and what he taught me about production managing and kind of taking on a different leadership role was, you know, very important part of my life to kind of watch that. And what was the reason why it was so important for me, I think, is because it was finally that point in my life where I was knew that I could design my future. And so it was kind of that point of, you know, I'm an audio engineer, I'm a tech, right? Well, I want to be an audio engineer. So I just tell people I'm an audio engineer and I just go do it and figure it out, right? And it was kind of like, well, who's that guy's boss? Well, it's the production manager. Great. That's what I'm doing. You know, that's the life I'm going to design for myself. And then from there it was, you know, well, who's the production manager's boss or who kind of runs the tour? Oh, it's the tour manager. Great. I want to tour manage. That's what I'm going to do. And kind of stepped into a tour management role. So leading tours and building teams and doing that for years. And then from there, same kind of thing is, okay, well, you know, who oversees the tours? Who oversees that part of it? It's the manager, right? And so just kind of stepping into that management role and designing that path for myself. And I think, you know, as silly as it is designing your life and figuring it out, that's kind of how it all worked. I mean, I literally told people I was a tour manager and I've never tour managed a day in my life. And they're like, oh, you are? Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's what I do. And you get thrown into it. You create this opportunity, you create this, you know, this person that you want to be, and you just do it and you're it. And all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I did it. I made it happen. Now what, you know, what's
the proverbial fake it till you make it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of how that's the, you know, really long story of how I kind of kept going down the management.
So were you in San Diego most of that time, or when did you transition to Nashville?
Yep, I was in San Diego pretty much that whole time. I moved to Nashville about 9 years ago. There was an artist in town that was just breaking, and they wanted somebody to kind of build that team to help him grow, build the team around him, brought me in as a tour manager, building his road team, building his band, kind of building the family and the culture around him, a really young kid. And I did that, and it was very successful, and he's very talented. It was an amazing experience. And as it grew so fast, I ended up kind of stepping into more of a management role and just kind of handling day-to-day stuff between tour managing, you know, even audio engineering, just kind of like everything I needed to do to kind of help grow his career. And or just help support, you know, where he needed it.
So do we get to hear who this first artist was that you managed?
First moving here.
Yeah.
His name was Hunter Hayes. And yeah, he's talented and amazing, amazing musician, amazing guy. He's, yeah, it was quite a journey with him. You know, we spent 8 years together, and unfortunately, you know, just recently we parted ways. But no, it was an amazing journey. It was a really important time for me too to work with him. You know, coming into Nashville at that time, something on the rise, something as Nashville's still just kind of growing, and you know, the country music genre is changing a little bit, and it's kind of that moment where, you know, country music is, there's a ton of people moving to town. There's a lot of growth. There's a lot of things happening and changing and moving. So came into town for that, thinking it would just be maybe a temporary solution. I'm not sure. And I never looked back. I never went back to San Diego. You know, just ended up moving out. Had some friends move all my stuff out from San Diego. I never went back. That's and it's awesome. The best move I've ever made. It's great.
Yeah. Well, and it's safe to assume that when you moved to Nashville, Nashville just started going nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can attribute your moving here to the town's growth.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, totally. It was all me. No, Nashville was I stumbled across Nashville right at the beginning of that when it started going crazy. I remember like things like the Gulch where they tried to build this little area of town. They couldn't, it wasn't working. There wasn't enough buzz yet. And so I remember these condos in the Gulch that they couldn't give them away. They couldn't sell these things because it just wasn't working. And
where was I at that time?
Yeah, exactly. And now, you know, they're $1 million condos and it's, you know, right in the heart of downtown and it's an amazing spot. But it's been amazing to watch this town grow and, you know, watch people come here. And yeah, it's pretty magic.
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of what artist management is, how it's different from working, you know, specifically for a record label, and then that relationship that comes with artists, because like you said, sometimes it's not a forever thing. What is that like as an artist manager and kind of the relationship with the artists? Are they normally long-term, short-term, contract-based, relationship-based within the scope of the big picture of an artist touring and recording and all those things?
Well, yes, management is definitely relationship-based. And, you know, I don't think that there's really a set structure on what management is. Some managers have contracts. Some managers don't. It's a handshake deal. Some managers are very involved. Some managers step back and kind of have some day-to-days, handle it until it gets to a certain level. So some managers, there's some companies that, you know, acquire other smaller managers and smaller artists, you know, just to be under their umbrella. There's just so many ways about, you know, how to manage an artist or who's managing or what the relationship is. Sometimes you're, you know, if you work for a company, you're thrown an artist that, hey, this is your new day-to-day manager. And obviously you build a relationship with those artists. Sometimes it's your childhood best friend that has made it. And now you're with them and you're helping them grow. So I think there's not really a set structure on what that is, but overall as an artist manager, yeah, it's relationship based and our job is to guide and counsel an artist based on their vision and where they want to go with their career. So the way I describe a manager, and this is just one way of looking at it, is, you know, I'm holding this LaCroix can for people that can't see, but if an artist is a LaCroix can and that artist wants to be in every single hand and every person in the world, how do we make that happen? You know, how do we come up with that vision in creative marketing strategies, you know, even from production or recording or producer, you know, what production facility are we going to use? What distribution are we going to use to get that LaCroix into every hand in the world, you know? So it's very similar in the sense of as an artist, they want their music heard by everybody, right? As big as you can possibly get it. And so how do we do that? What producers do we record with? And that's it's a big collaboration, you know, with an artist at that level. You got to collaborate with everybody, right? You got to collaborate with this record label, the band, with everybody. You got to be in sync, I guess, while still kind of following the artist's vision, making sure that we're in, you know, following that same path. So anything from the recording process, distribution, marketing strategies, you know, once it comes time when music's heard and things are going well, how do we build a tour around it? You know, what's the tour look like? How many dates? What markets are hot? You know, is it working globally? Do we move into a global market? You know, what do we do there? So I think as a manager, it's just kind of advise and counsel those, you know, making sure that we're in line with the artist's vision and we're making things happen there, I guess.
I love
it. If that all makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of in theme of how you sort of designed your career path, you know, from saying, this is what I want to be, I'm going to start telling people on this. Is there a similar kind of mentality that goes into that with managing an artist as far as if they're currently playing, you know, honky tonks and small bars and they want to start playing theaters, you kind of fake it till you make it? Or is it a very structured kind of streamlined path? Because I know that the game has changed a little bit over the last decade, especially with digital streaming and everything else. Has that impacted the touring and the way that all happens as well?
Yeah, it's definitely changed. And it's, I think just in general in business, my personal opinion is there's a lot more ways to market a song and a product, I guess, or let's, you know, sticking with music, there's a lot more ways to market it and get it out there, but that means there's a lot more noise to cut through. Right. And so I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the best song wins if it's heard by enough people. Right. And so, you know, yes, there's a strategy, but at the end of the day, the song's got to connect with fans. And so, but the beauty of today with digital is you can kind of pivot on a dime. You know, you can put a ton of marketing dollars on one song and it goes, but you realize the other song you released on Spotify just to put it out is blowing up. Well, let's pivot and throw some money towards that song and kind of grow that. And, you know, to answer your question, people that want to play, you know, people that want to play arenas, yes, you absolutely have a vision and a path and a plan and goals on how to get it there. But, you know, at the end of the day, the music has to connect, you know, the music really has to connect.
Yeah. One of my favorite phrases is the market always wins, mm-hmm. right? You can't, especially in the creative world, you can't subjectively make something that you love and then just force it on people. They're mm-hmm. never going to yep. see it the same way you do. I just had an experience with somebody creating a great product, but it wasn't what the world loved, and that's okay. You know, you pivot, you move on, and you just keep at it.
Yep.
I love Chris Stapleton. I think was talking about, he has written, you know, well over 1,000 songs or some insane number, but he wrote most of them for him, you know, and then he would write songs for other people, but he was like, as an artist, those aren't the songs I want to play. And so for a long time he fought being an artist, and then eventually, you know, it came to fruition and he became, what was it, a musician of the year, newcomer of the year,
yeah,
I think. So yeah. It's just interesting how, you know, in this creative world, creative process, the market always wins.
Yeah,
period.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you say that. I mean, I creative types don't necessarily like this thought process and this viewpoint on it. But, you know, to your point, you know, again, if this LaCroix was the product and I wanted it to taste like salt and pepper because that's my favorite thing, then great, I'm going to sell 3 cans of it to the people that want a soda right. that tastes like salt and pepper, right? Yeah,
that.
But, you know, and that people put a lot of time and effort into that, to making a great product that people want to enjoy and love. And, you know, you got to keep that in mind. You know, there's a ton of musicians that just want to open up and write poetry in their bedroom to release some emotions and feelings, you know, and some of those will connect with other people, some of them won't. But, you know, you kind of got to realize that going into it. And there's some people that go write songs that mean absolutely nothing to them just because that's what the people want to hear, you know. So finding that lane that kind of satisfies both of those is I think, the goal.
So Nashville, I mean, I'd be interested to know the statistics of how many talented musicians move into this town every single day. It's insane. If you're a musician and you're ready to take that next step, how do you get an artist manager? How do you get to that point? Do you have to be discovered? Can you knock on the front door at Starstruck and say, hey, I'm here to hire a manager? How does that process work? What's kind of the inside of getting to that point where you're ready for a manager?
I think it's a little of both. I have told this story 100 times. I just told it this morning, but there was this this awesome pop singer, this kid from Florida, and he comes to Nashville and he's getting ready to play this show. And it, coming from an artist, this means even more to me. But, you know, he came, me and him just started talking. Great guy. Forget his name, but great guy, great voice, amazing artist. And he said, man, I came to Nashville with this dream of, like, getting the record label and the booking agent and the publishing deal so I can really make the music that I want to make. And I was so excited. And he stops and he kind of looks at the sky a little bit and he looks at me and he says, you like cupcakes? And I'm like, yeah, man, where are we going? You like vanilla cupcakes? I'm like, sure, man. You know, yeah, of course, like vanilla cupcakes. He said, imagine I'm on Shark Tank and I tell all the sharks that I have the best vanilla cupcake. It's the most amazing vanilla cupcake. It's going to melt in your mouth. You'll never have anything like this. And they get excited, their mouths start watering, and they're like, okay, well, yeah, do you have a sample? Oh, well, I can't really give you a sample until you invest in me. And he said, and that's kind of a mentality with a lot of these new artists is, oh, I'm going to come to Nashville and get a record deal and a publishing deal and a booking agent, and they're going to do the work and make me a big star. And the reality of it is for companies to invest that much time and money into somebody, they want to see that it's working. They want to see that they've built a market. They've built a story for themselves. They have a vision for their company. They have, you know, they have all these pieces in place, you know. And so once you have that and you've built that foundation, it's easier to find a manager and a team to put around you. But if you're just, you know, a kid that has a couple good songs that you wrote in your bedroom, you know, it's really tough to find that, you know, to find that team that's going to support that. Not saying that it doesn't happen. Some people will believe in you and some people want to take that chance, but you know, at the end of the day, people want to see that drive and that hunger and that, you know, I'm building it. You know, I want to build this thing, and I don't care whether you're with me or you're against me, I'm building this future. So
I love it. I love it. So let's talk a little bit about where the music business is right now. Again, you've been at it for a while from both a production standpoint, management standpoint. You've seen kind of ins and outs. But there's a lot of talk that the industry's changed a lot. Again, digital streaming has certainly affected how album sales happen. Vivo and YouTube has affected how music videos are distributed and consumed. From your perspective, just where is the music business right now compared to where it used to be? And then conversely, where do you see it going?
You know, as far as digital streaming, again, going back to how many ways to put music out there now, there's a lot, and there's a lot of talent out there. There's a lot of artists out there. And, you know, we've seen it now with, like, Chance the Rapper and a bunch of other ones, right? You kind of can do it on your own and build a successful career on your own without, you know, major support. And you know, I think that that's the beauty of the digital age, you know. I think that there's still a lot to be figured out as far as payment goes, royalties, songwriters, and keeping that alive and healthy, you know, so people don't get burnt out. I mean, there's so many people, you know, in this office upstairs, we have probably 20 songwriters upstairs right now, and their job is to write songs. You know, that's their life, that's their career. And when you're not getting paid on that, you know, when you're in there working 40 hours a week writing songs and you might make 20 grand this year, it's really, really tough, you know. And I don't think anyone wants to go to work 40 hours a week and then go network and play shows and do all this for 20 grand a year. And so I think that there's a lot to figure out. And 20 grand a year is an example. Like, don't quote me on that.
We'll get all kinds of messages, I'm sure, on that one.
Yeah, I don't know what they make. I really don't. I mean, it all depends. But it's an example of, you know, how much work they put in and, you know, at some point the pay's got to equal out. And so I think that there's a lot to figure out as far as payment. I'm not saying it's wrong or it's bad. I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot to stay on top of to keep the arts alive, you know, to keep the writing process alive, especially.
Yeah. And in one regard, it's much easier now to consume and get yourself out there and everything else. But it used to be so cut and dry. Mm-hmm. You write a song, it gets on an album, you get paid,
yeah.
You know, and we kind of, it was a very simple mathematic equation. And now it's like, well, this song could end up streaming and hit millions of hits. And then, who knows what that's worth?
Yeah. And, you know, everyone knows this, but just to kind of put it in people's face and just have people remember that, like, you know, as an artist, not just a songwriter, but as an artist, when you have a big team of all those people that I mentioned, a publisher, a booking agent, a business manager, an attorney, a manager, you know, they all take a cut. And so, you know, everyone has a piece. Everyone needs to get paid. It's a business. And so when you get another person takes a cut, or those royalties aren't paying out, or whatever's not paying, you know, it's really hard to be an artist or a songwriter, you know, and make a living at it. It's a fun hobby in your bedroom, but, you know, it's still people's lives, you know. It's their Absolutely. Career.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you think is kind of on the horizon of, have you seen anything fun or innovating or kind of exciting that, you know, you're looking forward to in the next few years as far as the music business is concerned?
There's so much, to be honest with you. There's a new company here pitching about some sort of AI recording process or voice recognition software or voice matching software. And there's so much going on right now that it's, who knows what's next, to be honest with you. I mean, who knows? The biggest part is just making sure that it's connecting with fans, right? That's the biggest part of the music industry. Is it connecting with the fan in the best way, you know?
Absolutely.
Because fans kind of see right through all the noise as well. They just want to connect. They want to connect with an artist, feel like they're connected with an artist through their music, through their personality, through their social media channels or whatever that is. And when it feels like it's not authentic anymore is when you start seeing people kind of drop off, especially in country music. You know, they're so loyal to their fans, and and it's authentic. It's true. They want to meet their fans. They want to be there, you know. Story of Garth Brooks signing for 26 hours or whatever, or Taylor. I mean, that's real. They want to do this stuff, you know. Yeah. They don't feel obligated. And so...
So the human connection is never going to go away. We always need to find ways to bring it back to that human connection. I mean, as a storyteller myself, it's all about that exact same thing. How do you create a connection with the brand, with the organization, that doesn't feel inauthentic, that always allows for the viewer or the consumer or the fan to feel like they're a part of something? I saw this thing the other day. The Dallas Cowboys, they have this big display, I think at the football stadium, and there's a camera, and it'll take the environment you're in, capture that environment, put you back there, and then through augmented reality, it pops those players in around you. So now it looks like you have a picture with your favorite five players. And I thought that was the coolest thing. Do any artists do anything like that, that kind of gives you almost instant access, even though it's augmented reality?
Actually, yes. And what's really funny about that is we just talked about that last night. There's an app out there, a really great app that does like a lot of business to business, called Video Bomb, and it's amazing. And they do the same kind of thing. Point your camera at anything. You can point it at this LaCroix can, and all of a sudden you have a, you know, you pick an artist, movie, actor, pop out of the LaCroix can, kind of tell you more about it, and just have augmented reality opportunities like that. So it is more and more, and you can walk around to a concert, Lollapalooza, pointed at something, and one of the artists will pop out and you can take a picture with them if that's what you want to use. So there's a lot of those happening right now, but also there's a lot of, I've seen a lot of app companies come out with like virtual meet and greets where you can sit and actually have a FaceTime meet and greet with an artist just from your phone. You know, there's a lot of access to artists now, you know, but I think, you know, it's scary because I feel like a lot of people now expect the access to the artist. You know, when we go to shows, everybody expects to get backstage because they bought a ticket, you know, and they're really upset if they don't. And yeah. So it's really, you know, because there's so much access, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to navigate sometimes.
I was having a conversation actually a couple of years ago in LA with the marketing director for the Goodyear blimp, and she was trying to come up with ideas, brand partnerships, different ways to market the Goodyear blimp, because most people don't realize that is a 100% marketing effort for Goodyear. I mean, it's functional at football games, but it's obviously marketing for Goodyear. And she's like, we want to find new innovative ways to market it. And so at the time, somebody had come out with augmented reality where you point your phone at something and it sort of identifies that thing and it transforms it into something else. And so we were talking about, like, you know, what if we go to Lucas Enterprise and turn the Goodyear blimp, you point your phone at it, turns into a ship from Star Wars or something, you know, so all of a sudden you can take pictures of, like, you saw one of the Star Wars ships flying through the air, but it's really a Goodyear blimp. But when it has to do with humans, does that get a little scary from an artist manager standpoint, where people feel like, hey, I want to take a picture with this person, I kind of have a fake version of it, and I don't know, it just seems like there could be almost a line that people would cross, because some fans get crazy, let's be honest.
Yeah, And, you know, I think it's definitely got to be branded as such. And, it, you know, there is a lot of, there's a lot of things you can do with a picture of, you know, somebody that doesn't know they're there, right? You can make some really bad examples, and that can circulate the internet. So that can be scary for sure. I think that, you know, there's a lot of things happening where you're using an artist name, likeness, image, voice without them knowing is a very scary thing, you know? Yeah. So if they have a voice or an image or something that is offending fans that they didn't even know they used, you're going the wrong direction, right? So it's very scary. And that's part of our job, is to kind of watch all that stuff and make sure that nothing like that gets out. Every picture's accounted for, every interview, you know, is making sure it's in the right hands.
How much of what you see, I mean, just industry-wide, you know, we see things all the time that we call fake news or this or that or the other, because everybody now has access to cameras and video, and we can post our own content everywhere we go. Do you see a lot of people doing the wrong thing with it?
I think that there's a lot of people that just want reaction, especially reaction on the internet. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a giant amount of people, a large amount of people in the world that is looking for the most amount of likes, clicks, you know, these analytics to show that they're popular, and whatever that it takes to get there, they'll do that. Whether it's a goofy meme, whether it's a, you know, politically incorrect video, whatever those things are that's going to get a reaction, I feel like that's what's driving people some of the time.
So not every artist or entertainer is this way, but a lot of them are great personalities, right? That's part of what I would think makes them who they are and likable and great on stage. Do you have any good funny stories of any artists that come out that just, you know, that you like being around, or that you've seen kind of behind the scenes do things that most people might not know?
I don't think I have any specific stories. However, I will say that I think one of my favorite people of all times, and this isn't because he's on our roster at all, but Blake Shelton is exactly what you see is what you get. I mean, he is hilarious. He's got the best personality. He's always a great person to be around. I mean, it's great. You know, even before I started working here and he's been on our roster, I've toured with him for years. I mean, 10 years ago, it was the first time we started working together. And I mean, he's that way. You know, what you see is exactly what you get. He's just as real as it gets. He just tells it like it is, and you just love him for it. You know, I love Blake, but I wish I had some good stories for you. If I think of some, I'll let you know.
It's all good. Yeah. Well, that was definitely one of the things I wanted to get to, was sort of the artists under y'all's management and kind of who stands out. But of course, Blake, you know, now that he's on The Voice and he's a staple on a major TV show, is that becoming more and more commonplace in the industry where people start to cross over? Because I would assume that affects his ability to put out new albums and tour and everything else, but or maybe it doesn't.
It definitely affects it in a good way, but you know, the people that shine through on TV, I think it's just a different thing. I mean, they're just like you said, it's personality, right? You have to have a big personality on TV for it to translate. And so with that being said, no, I don't think it is for everybody. I don't think some artists belong on TV, you know, just based on what you're looking for. But no, Blake, we have Kelly Clarkson on our roster, and she has her own TV show now. And she obviously is on The Voice, and she has the best personality. And, you know, and it's real. They're not putting it on for TV. That they're like that off stage. They're like that if they came and hung out with us right now. You know, they just have this great, amazing, infectious personality. And that's why they're amazing on TV. You just want to hang out with them, right? That's just the kind of personality they have. And that's the kind of people they are.
So is that just kind of back to the artist management side of things? Are those contracts, are those career moves still things that fall under you guys as the artist managers to help them make those decisions? Or when it goes outside of the music world, do they kind of make their own decisions or work with other people on that? Or is it just whatever the situation is for that individual artist?
No, there's obviously another team of people that are brought into their world once you have TV, you know, maybe different agents, different TV agents versus music agents and things like that. But overall, management kind of is there to help guide the artist, you know, the best moves for them, you know, advise and counsel and making sure that they're on point and looking out for the artist's best interest. Obviously, you know, whether it's a record label or TV or agency or whatever, everyone has their own agenda. And I'm not saying that's bad, but everyone has their own agenda. And so just making sure that somebody's looking out for the artist's behalf and with the best interest for of the artist.
So you mentioned a couple of people that have sort of been instrumental in launching your career, that you still have great relationships today. Who are some of the people that you continue to look at now and say, you know, that's where I need to be, or that's kind of who I want to emulate, or that's where I want to go? Do you have those people, those mentors that are pushing you further and harder? And since you've designed your career to this point, you kind of are looking at that next step?
Yeah, I think that I honestly feel that the universe has brought me to this company for that reason. I honestly do. I think that the owner of Starstruck, Narvel Blackstock, is my biggest mentor. I mean, he really is. He's just a brilliant man, and it's the fact that I get to work with him every day is incredible. But he's taught me more, I think, about this industry and management in general in the past year and a half than the 18 years of my career, you know. And he's just been an amazing leader for the company and just for me personally.
So what do you personally do to kind of continue developing yourself, growing? You know, are you a reader? What are the kinds of things that kind of push you further and further in your career?
I'm a nerd when it comes to personal growth and, like, you know, self-help and personal development and those type of books and learning. And I'm really big on mental health and just taking care of yourself. And I think that this is very cliche to say. I mean, everyone says it, but, you know, if your inner world is not strong, your outer world's not going to be strong. Your outer world's going to look like crap, you know? And so, like, taking care of yourself first and making sure that you're strong mentally, physically, healthy, you know, internally is going to give you a better chance of success externally. You know, once you can kind of take on that personal responsibility that you can design your own life, you know, but it all starts within, you know, once you kind of accept that and understand that, you know, you kind of look at view the world a little bit differently. And you kind of have for me personally, I have a much better success rate of happiness. When I wake up, I know that I'm on, you know, 80% or above on the happiness scale, you know,
that's a pretty good percentage.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a sort of tactical standpoint, what does that mean for Dan? What is a daily kind of, best case scenario from the time you wake up to go to bed? What do you do to keep that happiness above 80% or whatever?
Exercise every day, no matter what. That's the one thing that I've learned about myself, that mentally, when I don't do something in the morning, mentally I'm just a little bit more drained. Everything's just a little bit harder. And, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, just getting that blood flowing first thing in the morning is crucial for me.
Your
I have to do
cardio
it.
Guy, weights, yoga, combination.
All of it, yeah. Sure. Just something that's, you know, really loving. The company just got a Peloton bike upstairs.
Oh, nice,
and I'm really enjoying that. But just anything, really. I mean, even if it's a light jog, even if it's 25 push-ups and you're done, even if it's, you know, 10 jumping jacks out of bed, whatever that thing is that just really kind of gets you moving and blood flowing is really important to me, and that's crucial. But, you know, I think, you know, meditation is huge. I mean, it's very important. And, you know, visualization, imagery of what you want your life to look like and what you want even your day to look like, you know, taking that few minutes to just kind of, you know, view what this outcome is. You know, a buddy of mine sent me a video of the Blue Angels and how they do this imagery and this chair flying, and they walk through their whole process sitting in a conference room table before they even jump in the plane. I mean, from the time they close that, you know, close the cockpit, you know, window or whatever, till the time they're back on the ground, they talk through and visualize the whole process. And, you know, athletes do it. It's very important, you know, all these mental skills coaches and, you know, the mental skills team on every sports team has them, you know, and they do the same thing, the visualization, the imagery, the staying present, you know, versus getting in your head about what went wrong in the past, worried about what's going to be in the future. That's not going to serve you well. You know, you're not going to be on your best level, your highest level of performance, if you're worried about those things, you know.
Yeah, you can get me geeking out over the Blue Angels, the Thunderbirds, those guys. I love to watch all their behind the scenes. They if you follow them on Instagram. They post some really cool stuff. Mm. But you're exactly right. I think the mental preparation that goes into any, especially, you know, at that level, there is no margin for error. Mm-hmm. But if you translate that down, why would you not do that for any important decision you have to make in life? Mm-hmm. You know, whether that's designing your career, if you have a big meeting that day, visualize the outcome and play to that. Like if you've already visualized it, you can make it happen.
Yeah.
But I think that's such a simple tactical thing that most people don't even contemplate.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really, sometimes it's really hard to look in the mirror and understand that you have the power. It's easy to blame everything else around you for, absolutely, you know, it's really easy. And it's really hard to sit and ask yourself what you want and where you want your life to be. And it doesn't have to be that big right away, I don't feel. You don't have to sit down and write a book about what you want your life to be right now. But if you can take those 10, 15 minutes and really just kind of like calm down, be present, you know, understand that you have control of your situation for the day. You know, I think that that's why it's so important for me to wake up and work out, is because I don't feel like it. I wake up every morning at 5 a.m., whether I want to or not, just to kind of put me in this position of like, no, I control what I want to do in life. This is for me. Then this is what I have to do to make me a better person.
Any other daily routines, tactics, kind of, you know, are you a pretty healthy eater, or do you just kind of eat what comes along?
I try to be, but I slip quite a bit. I always make a breakfast. Always make a big breakfast. Really healthy, just peppers, eggs, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe turkey bacon or something like that. But I always make breakfast. Me and my girlfriend, she works out with me every morning, and she didn't realize what she's getting into, but she gets up and supports me, and we work out together every morning and do something active, and we have a nice breakfast. And we have a good routine just on a relationship level, is we've only been together maybe, you know, 10 months now, I guess, and or maybe a little bit longer, but we, you know, when we got together, we just talked about how, you know, we're in love, this is really great, and let's set ourselves up for success. Let's not leave anything unsaid. Let's make sure that we're having a good, healthy communication. And we downloaded this app that a buddy told me about called Lasting, and it's like a marriage counseling app. And you kind of, you know, there's different lessons that you can learn based on your profile that you picked. And, you know, every day there's a daily reflection. And so when we eat breakfast every single morning, we pull open the daily reflection, and it gives us like some things to talk about and some things to understand better about each other. So that leads into a little conversation to kind of get to know each other a little bit more and really like create a safe place for us to communicate and to talk to each other and feel like, okay, sometimes when there's things that are hard, it's okay. It's okay to sit there and talk about it, you know? And so we've kind of created a really great system for us to be able to just like openly communicate about anything and feel that it's safe to talk about. So nothing, you know, there's no resentment 5 years later of something that was left unsaid, you know?
That's awesome.
So yeah, we do that every morning or 5 days a week. Weekends, typically we, you know, have other stuff going on, but every 5 days a week we do that.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I think that's important to me as well. It's just understanding. I think I read a book called Crucial Conversations that somebody turned me on to, and I think that was really big on helping me understand how to communicate to people and how to have those deeper conversations and realize that it's okay, you know, that it's okay to start talking and have something a little bit deeper. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So I want to run into, speaking of books, a couple of kind of quick hit questions. You know, first thing that comes to mind, starting with the best or latest book you've read.
I'm in the middle of a book called Pitch Anything, and I don't know if you've read it, but it's just about closing deals and pitching, and I'm only into chapter two, but it's an interesting read. Definitely the psychology behind pitching and making deals happen.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that one out for sure. Best piece of advice you've ever given or received?
Received is a guy that I mentioned in this conversation, John Shimke, Rasta John. He has big dreads, you know, down to his ankles. And he's always told me that when we started touring together when I was 18, is to thank everybody and be thankful for everybody, because, you know, you never know when that person's going to be back in your life, and you never know. And so anyone from stagehands helping loading in concerts to, you know, you being here, you know, I'm very grateful for those people. And I think that's the best advice I've ever been given.
Mm, that's good. If you were to write a book, what would the title be?
Oh boy.
Or I like this one. I borrow this one from Tim Ferriss. But if you had a billboard and it could have one simple message on it, what would that message be?
That's a tough question.
It's kind of tough on the spot.
What would yours be?
Well, if I were to write a book,
yeah,
and this involves a little bit of explanation, it would be called The Problem with Freedom.
Okay.
Kind of intriguing title,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the idea there has nothing to do with patriotic freedom, yeah, nothing to do with our country's freedom. It has everything to do with individual freedom.
Uh-huh.
The more decisions we have in life, the harder it is to make a good decision. So the more freedom we have, the more kind of clammed up we get. We don't want to make a decision because we have so many options.
Hmm.
So when it comes to things like personal finances, if you have a hard time saving money, take the decision-making away and automate moving money into your bank account that you want to save so that you don't have to make that decision anymore.
Hmm.
Since we have freedom to spend money, we spend it all and we mm-hmm. don't save enough. So take away the freedoms that are disabling you to live the life you want to live and create routines and practices that aren't decision-making. Wake up every morning at 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give yourself the ability to think the night before, what time should I get up tomorrow?
Yeah.
Because you're always going to sleep 15 minutes longer, 30 minutes longer, an hour longer. If you say, I'll work out tomorrow, but, or, you know, whatever, you're going to work out 3 days a week, then work out 3 days a week. Don't make it a decision. Make it a thing you actually do.
Yeah.
And so the idea of the book would be, the problem with freedom is that when we have too many freedoms, we're paralyzed and we don't move forward.
It's very true. I've been there in my life.
Yeah. I think we all have. So that's my book.
I think my billboard would say, make it extraordinary. Whatever like that is, whatever you want to make extraordinary, make it the best. You
yeah.
know, I feel like that's because you can. And I think that to your point, you know, as we're talking about it, I think that you can design anything you want, right? You can be whatever you want and it can be as amazing as you want it to be. I have this really interesting view on life that I don't know if a lot of people have, but I honestly don't feel that someone has to lose in order for someone to win. I feel like everyone can win and you can have it all. You know, you can have all the happiness, you can have everything you want. And so, and you know, I think that I went through a period of my life where I felt like, oh, well, things are great now, which means they're going to be really crappy later. And that's not the case. You know, it doesn't have to be like that. And so, I think that everyone can win all the time.
Absolutely. And yeah. I don't think that's out of bounds at all. I think the terminology win-win comes from somewhere
mm-hmm.
and there's win-win scenarios all the time. I was just talking to somebody the other day that had their corporate culture is a win-win culture. And it's not, you know, if I do this and it gets me a promotion, then somebody else loses. It means we can all rise together. And, a lot of times we want to have that win-lose scenario in life, but the reality is even people that lose it, you know, quote unquote, lose at something, if they view it the right way, they're gaining something,
mm-hmm.
right? They're figuring out, okay, well, I know what I need to improve on. So that's an educational experience that I can now take and, you know, use for myself to better myself. And I think a lot of times people just view, you know, if you're playing a basketball game and you're the one with fewer points, you lost the game. Well, in most scenarios, that's true. But what can you gain from that? How can
yeah.
you view that as a win?
There's an author here in town named Donald Miller. And he's in Nashville. He has a book called Story Brand. But
he's one of my favorites.
He's my favorite too. I get the Business Daily tips every morning in my email. And he had this one that he said, you know, start looking at everything in your life as how it was good for you. And he said, even if you're stuck in traffic, think of why being 5 minutes late to this meeting is going to be the best thing that's ever happened to you. Maybe you met you met somebody at the right time, or maybe, you know, every situation when somebody yells at you, it happened because what good can you find out of every single situation in your life? And I try to do that every day, you
yeah.
know, so.
And to me, that goes back to the idea of the problem with freedom. We know we have the option to think of it positively or negatively. What if you thought of everything as a positive scenario?
Mm-hmm.
You take away the opportunity or the option of thinking of something negatively, period. If you just said everything I hear, receive, think about, there's a positive spin on it, then all of a sudden you see the world a different way.
Yeah. Agreed.
And I'm preaching to myself here because I'm not great at it.
No, I'm with you. It takes practice. You know, no one's great at it. I mean, no one's perfect at it. But if you make it a habit, like you know, you wake up and you do these things because, you know, it makes you feel better, you know, and you make it a habit to see the positive in certain situations, and you make it a habit to eat healthier, and you make it a habit to make better connections and to talk to your wife or spouse or, you know, husband or whatever every single day and open up. You make it a habit to do these things because it makes you happier, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's really easy to lose the habit and fall out of it, you know, but if you create it and keep going and you're focused on that mission, that you're creating your happiness, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up Donald Miller because he is one of my favorites. He's doing a great job with his brand, with his conferences, with his content that he's putting out there. Couple of my other favorites, one of them here in Nashville, Jeremy Cowart. You familiar with Jeremy?
I don't know.
He's
in
Franklin. He's a photographer. He's currently far along in the process of building a new hotel downtown called the Purpose Hotel. Have
yes,
you heard of that?
Yes, I have. Actually, I've met him.
Okay.
He did some super stuff for CMA Fest maybe 2 years ago.
Okay.
CMA yeah. Foundation.
So Jeremy's fantastic. He has a book that came out a while ago called I'm Possible, play off of Impossible, the idea that you can do anything you want to do. If you because he's one of those that he wasn't great in school and people said he'll never make a living as a creative and all that. And now he's like one of the most successful celebrity and entertainment photographers out there, building a hotel. He's not a hotelier, but he's become one, you know, because he said he can do it and he's a super creative guy. And then another guy that I love to read his stuff and pay attention to his content is Chase Jarvis.
I don't know Chase either.
He was a photographer for years and still is, but started a brand called Creative Live. That's online content for creatives. If you're trying to learn certain skills, all, you know, anything in the creative industry, including business and entrepreneurship for creatives. But he just released a book called Creative Calling. The idea that everybody is creative. You just have to unleash it and kind of put it out there. And that, you know, the second you say you're not creative, then you're not creative.
Yeah.
But the second you say you are, you are. So, anyway, just an aside, some of my favorites.
That. Thank you for that. That's great.
All right. So last thing, favorite artist, you got to have somebody that stands out.
Favorite artist, musician. I, this is crazy, but probably Jay-Z.
Nice. Oh, that's good.
I love Jay-Z so much. I love, I don't know. I'm kind of all over the map. You know, I'll create a playlist when I get to work. As soon as I sit down, I'll open up Spotify and I'll just kind of like drop songs into a queue, whatever I'm feeling that day. And it'll take me on a journey throughout my work day and I'll be done with it. So, but I'm all over the place where the other day was, you know, maybe 70s funk or, you know, Bill Withers or something. And then, you know, yesterday was 80s, you know, it was anyone from Mr. to, you know, it was all over the place. So, but yeah, I'm all over the map. Hip hop, indie rock, pop, you know, I'm all over the place.
That's so good.
Yeah.
You should share those and let the world experience a day in the life of Dan's music taste.
Oh boy.
Well, Dan, this has been a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah.
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
If you liked this episode of Titans of Industry, head to contenttitan.co/podcast for more episodes or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. And if you know of an industry titan that's doing amazing things, let us know on social media or through our website so we can tell their story. Thanks for listening.